Members of the public, thank you for your patience as we get settled back in from a longer floor session than we expected. Representative Paymar, House File 2898 is your bill. Please present your bill, and if you want to move it, to bring it before the committee.
Chair, I would move House File 2898, and I believe this would go to the General Register.
I believe so, Representative Paymar. And do you have any amendments, Representative Paymar?
I do not.
Great. Proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, some of you have already heard this bill or a variation of it in the past or may remember the situation. My constituent, Toby Pearson, who is sitting to my left, there was a terrible tragedy in 2003 where his wife was killed in a plane crash in northern Minnesota, and his two girls were injured due to that crash. One of the girls spent a significant amount of time in the hospital. At the end of last session, we passed a bill which created basically a working group, an aviation insurance meet and confer group that was comprised of members of the Pilots Association and various representatives of the insurance industry to try to work out the language that you have before you. This group met for a significant amount of time, and basically the language that you have in front of you is straightforward. It seeks to establish in Minnesota statute that in order for the insurance or an insurance company to deny a claim, there must be a direct causal connection to the loss. In the situation involving my constituent, there was questions about the application that the pilot had made, and the insurance company denied claims to my constituent. So this essentially, what this means is that if there is a crash in the future, in order for the insurance company to deny the claim, the insured pilot's actions or failure to act must have a direct causal connection to the loss. There's similar laws in other states, and I'd like Toby Pearson to address the body briefly.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pearson. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I was married to Catherine Pearson, who died in the crash, and my daughters, Grace and Lily, were 3 and 4 at the time, and I'm happy to share with you they're 9 and 7 now, and they're complaining about math and spelling, so they're doing what little girls should be doing, apparently. This bill is a compromise that came out of a series of meetings that took place during the summer and into the fall. The meet and confer group was chaired by Representative Mike Beard. I believe the report has been distributed for your information. Ultimately, I think what we tried to do in this bill was balance the interests of the innocent third party, making sure that the pilots get what they pay for when they purchase insurance, and the insurance company's interest in being able to defend itself against potential bad actors. It doesn't necessarily eliminate all of the possibilities for innocent third parties, but I think it goes a long way in getting us to a compromise that the pilots are willing to accept and that I can support. And so I'm here to answer any questions.
I think we'll actually first go to Mr. Kavanaugh if he has any testimony, and we'll take questions from the committee. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Kavanaugh. State your name for the record and proceed as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm John Kavanaugh from Cook Hill Girard Associates. I'm here on behalf of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. AOPA actually participated in the Aviation Insurance Working Group this summer. Not only did they participate in it, they also support the final outcome of it, which in this case is House File 2898. Although not all members are of that working group are necessarily supportive of the exact final outcome, we believe that this is a compromise that balances the rights of injured parties and also the concerns that on the behalf of insurers and those policyholders that the premiums would actually skyrocket. And in this case, I believe this is a best-case scenario as far as the compromise is concerned. And in respect to the committee's time and your agenda, I will stand for questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Kavanaugh. Mr. Pearson, any questions from members? Seeing none, I just, Mr. Pearson, want to extend the sympathy to the committee for your loss in the accident. I want to thank everyone for working out a solution to this bill. I know it was a little bit contentious last year, and appreciate you working out those problems together over the interim. Seeing no questions from members and nothing further from Representative Paymar, Representative Paymar removes his motion in House File 2898. He recommended it to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Same sign. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Pilstrom, I believe you're prepared to proceed with House File 2627.
I believe my witness is here, Mr. Chair.
I see someone coming up with a little bit of fervor, so I think that that statement's correct. House File 2627, Representative Huston, the floor is yours. Proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 2627 be recommended to pass, and I believe go to the General Register.
Excellent. Proceed with your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is related to public nuisances, and it makes changes to the law that affects the evidentiary threshold. And I have a witness here that I'd just like to turn it over to. That would be all right.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Speaking of representatives, my name is Mark Weigel. I'm the vice president of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which represents 8,000 line officers throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm also a 24-year veteran of the St. Paul Police Department, where I currently work in our force unit that deals with problem properties. I deal with a lot of gun and drug-related incidents. What we're talking about here today is state civil statute 617.80, which defines nuisance properties and sets thresholds for use in response to behavioral incidents. There are a number of flaws in the current statute that hinder municipalities and property owners from being able to use it more effectively in dealing with problem properties. Currently, the statute calls for clear and convincing evidence. To meet that standard, officers would need to testify and police reports would need to be reviewed. This is problematic when dealing with ongoing investigations, which almost always take precedence to closing down a problem address, especially when dealing with narcotic-related issues. This essentially stops the municipality from using the statute to convince a property owner that problem behavior must cease. It also hinders responsible property owners who are looking for help in the form of information to prove lease violations and deal with problem tenants. We would like to see a change to a preponderance of evidence threshold. Public information of police reports would then meet the necessary level of proof to allow municipalities and owners to use the statute immediately. Also, currently, the statute requires two or more separate behavioral incidents to take place at an address within a 12-month period for a municipality to take action. We'd like to see this change to one incident if it involves the illegal use of a weapon, illegal drugs, or prostitution, allowing the municipality or rental property owners to bring recourse for these kind of actions. And then lastly, the statute currently defines a nuisance under Subdivision 2, Section 8 as unlawful use or possession of a firearm. By this definition, an occupant of the address could have hurt people with a machete or any other weapon, and the municipality cannot bring any recourse for this kind of behavior. We would like to see this change to the current definition of a dangerous weapon from State Statute 609.02, Subdivision 6. This would then allow municipalities and owners to use the statute when illegal use of any dangerous weapon occurs at the property.
Thank you, Mr. Weigel. Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The housing people just stopped me on my way over, and they said they didn't have a problem with my bill either.
Excellent. Good to hear. We like bills that don't have problems. Anybody from the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Questions from members? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to read quickly in the statute, and help me. with this. Is this legislation we passed recently where we could take over people's property, their building, is this related to the landlords? And is, remember we had a big fight about notice and whether it was fair to the landlords. So this doesn't change any. Does this relate to that part of the law?
Representative Hestrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not that I'm aware of. That has not been discussed with me at all. So,
Representative Hulbert, would you wish?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Verdon is saying to me that he thinks that was Representative Lesch's bill from last year.
Representative Hulbert, that was actually when I even read the title of the bill. That's what I first thought as well, is that it could refer to Representative last year, bill last year establishing essentially gang behavior as a public nuisance along those lines. Want to repeat the question quickly, Representative Hulbert?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I can speed this up given the time and the amount of people and bills. How can this be used against property owners for people that are on or in their property that do these things? This change of law only apply to action against the individuals doing these acts?
Mr. Regan?
The chairman and representative, this would, yes, it would deal with the folks that are in the property, but it would be asking the property owners to, if it's a rental property, to deal with their tenants if they have guns, illegal use of guns or drugs or prostitution, that type of thing. Or if it's a owner-occupied property, it is basically, like in St. Paul right now, we put them on notice that you've had an incident like this at your property, and that has worked very well for us in St. Paul. That usually stops the behavior at those properties at that point.
All right. And Mr. Chair, and just to be clear, I think this is what I was worried about. And so now we're going to change. So if there's one prostitution or prostituted-related activity, there are ramifications for the building owner and no ability to make necessary changes to stop it from happening again. And I mean, I don't have a problem if this is directed only at the quote-unquote bad actors, but if upon changing this section of statute, we then leave a situation where on a first offense, serious consequences can occur to a landowner, a renter, whatever. I think that's a little harsh.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hulbert, this actually gives the landlord the ability to do something.
And so, Chair, to be clear, in no way would a landowner suffer any, or a renter suffer any repercussions for one act of prostitution in their property if they had no knowledge or participation in it.
Representative Spokesman, Mr. Riedel, Mr. Gehring from Council is going to chime in here. I think he may have something to add to the discussion. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hulbert, I just looked up the statute that was enacted last session, and that if you're speaking to the gang nuisance provision, that was a separate section of statute and is not covered by Section 617.80 to 617.87. That's a different procedure for bringing a suit against a landowner, so this bill would not apply to those situations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rush.
And also, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, that statute when enacted last year required 3 incidents after it came through conference committee, and it wasn't a separate statute. I would note, though, that technically, courts did have the authority to enact nearly all of the prohibited conduct under that law, under the existing nuisance law. It's just the judges were hesitant to do that, so we set up a rubric for them to do that in the new law.
All right.
Any further questions from members? With that, Representative Hilton renews her motion that House File 2627 be recommended and passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The bill passed. Thank you, Representative Hilton. Representative Tamar, are you ready with House File 3228?
Thank you.
Representative Tamar, I'm searching for House File 3228. It appears you have an amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3228, and then I'd also like to move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Tamar moves House File 3228 and also moves the DE1 amendment. This is an author's amendment to get it in the shape that you would like it, correct?
That's correct.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. Proceed, Representative Tamar, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. St. Paul is home to nearly 600 miles of underground tunnels and sewers, and many of which are used to provide power, telephone, water, sewage, wastewater, and other related utility services to residents in our community. Utility companies and St. Paul public safety officials are concerned that vandals could do significant damage to critical infrastructure, or that trespassers could become trapped in hard-to-access points in the city tunnel and sewer system, requiring city personnel to undergo a dangerous and costly rescue. So this language, this legislation, would simply extend the current trespass statute to provide the same treatment to underground utility lines as above-ground utilities. Whether the tunnel is posted or not posted. Mr. Diebel is familiar with this law, and I have with me Commander Dan Anderson with the St. Paul Police Department.
And Mark Excel.
Yep. Okay. Mark Mullen with Excel Energy.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Commander Anderson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Dan Anderson. I'm a commander with the St. Paul Police Department. I've been there 24 years. I'm currently assigned to the Eastern District Investigation. In my previous assignment, I worked in a unit where we covered homeland security issues, critical infrastructure for the city. And back in 2006, I was assigned to look at the tunnel situation for the city of St. Paul. And in the fall of 2006, I began to gather information to learn the extent of these tunnels and what really did and didn't exist, what was rumor and what was reality. And I learned that there is quite an extensive system in downtown St. Paul. In the past, we have made, not a lot, but we have made some arrests where people were in these tunnels. In one situation, they were near the city courthouse and they lit fireworks inside the tunnel. And in the end, because of the current statute and the issue for posting, we were unable to actually charge anyone with a crime for being in those tunnels. Excuse me. While I was gathering information, what I learned is that various tunnels, the owners of these tunnels are the City of St. Paul with water, sewer, district heating and cooling, Xcel Energy, Quest, the Met Council, and the State of Minnesota. And according to the City of St. Paul Public Works, there's over 30,000 manhole covers in the City of St. Paul. By accessing these areas creates a danger to the public. One of those dangers is storm surges, similar to what we saw last summer with the unfortunate incident with the construction workers. There's electrocution hazards if they're in power tunnels, and in some areas there's bad air quality down there. In 2006 in Minneapolis, people who were trying to gather scrap wire entered an NXL Energy access vault below ground and proceeded to use a battery-operated tool to try to cut out a section of the wire. This gentleman was severely burned on both of his arms, so there's serious danger to people that don't know what they're doing going into these tunnels as well. The communications tunnels, there's a lot of lines that run through there. It's a serious critical infrastructure issue for the city and the state and residential customers as well as business. And if somebody were to gain access to there for criminal activity, it could shut down a good portion of business for the city and the state. And access to these tunnels, there are, as I said, there's over 30,000 manhole covers. There are other accesses also, and part of the issue is that if you start out in a city storm sewer, most of it due to unauthorized access created by people who weren't supposed to be in there. If you enter one system and just about anywhere in the system, you can access the other. So I could start in a city storm sewer, and I could end up in Excel property or Quest property in these tunnels as well. As I said, the current statute requires posting. Unfortunately, it's not practical cost-wise to try to secure or post the number of accesses that there are and still make it feasible for the people that have authority to be in there to do work to still gain access by trying to lock down every one of these or posting every one. And the issue with the underground, we understand that if it's above ground, you know, somebody could kind of accidentally wander onto a property. No one is going to accidentally end up in one of these underground tunnels. If you're down there, you know you're down there.
Excellent. Thank you, Commander Anderson. Mr. Mullen, please, Governing Committee, state your name for the record and proceed.
Mark Mullen, and I work as a senior security consultant for Xcel Energy. Basically, I'm here to talk about two particular incidents that occurred in Minneapolis where we have some real significant issues concerning breach of these underground tunnels. In one case, a person went into the tunnel to cut copper wire, and in so doing, he ended up causing an explosion. And it's a very tight, confined space. We've got a lot of big feeder cables down there and a lot of voltage. Apparently, this individual didn't know that. As he caused the explosion, he caused a significant injury to himself, but he also took out part of a hospital, a local hospital. And it just so happened that the hospital's emergency generator system failed, and they ended up evacuating an entire floor of medically compromised patients. It's one incident that we had dealt with back in 2005. In 2006, we had a similar incident where another individual, different individual this time, again went down into one of these tunnels. And this guy thought he'd be a little bit more sophisticated. He brought a home tester, voltage tester that you can pick up at a hardware store, and he tried testing voltage against one of these 18,000 volt lines that had a very good degree of padding around it, so he's not going to get through it. Saw that it didn't register, and he thought, I can cut this out, so he went ahead and started sawing away at it. He got probably a half inch into it, caused an explosion, melted his sawzall. I'd never seen a melted sawzall before, but this thing was just, the whole end of it was just completely melted off. Individual was severely burned, ended up going into the hospital for a prolonged period of time, and in this case, he caused an outage that actually took out the City of Minneapolis Waterworks and a local munitions plant. So two critical infrastructures that were directly impacted by this. As the commander said, we have these tunnels all over the place. We've got manholes all over the place. The type of equipment that we keep in there, the type of power equipment that we keep in there is significant power equipment, and it is necessary to continue the reliability of our electrical supply to the city. The city, the state, and so on and so forth. At any rate, those. The other thing I wanted to add about that, and this we see in a lot of the copper theft that's been going on, when people cut through our fences in our service centers and our utility areas, and then they leave access for anybody else who might wander by, like children, and there's obviously a safety hazard. You know, these individuals, when they go into these tunnels, they're leaving them. They're leaving the tunnels wide open. They don't care who comes after them and continues access. And it is something that concerns us, not only from a standpoint from civilians going in there, children, but our own workers who go in there for, problems that might occur, severe issues concerning safety.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Before we go to Representative Rush, Commander Anderson, I understand that this issue is of serious concern in providing adequate safety for the Republican National Convention this summer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I wouldn't be honest if I said that had nothing to do with it, but the important point I want to make is that when this started out, it actually has nothing to do with that. That's obviously an added concern this year. But the issue and concern of the tunnels was here long before and will be here long after that comes about.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Commander. Representative Lutch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first question is for Commander Anderson or Mr. Mullen, if he knows. The stories where people were trying to pilfer copper wire, whatever they were trying to take in those instances, were they or could they have been charged with a crime?
Yes, I'll answer that question, sir. The individuals in this particular case were not charged because they got away from the crime area and there was no direct evidence linking them back to the tunnel. I mean, it was obvious to us that by virtue of their burns, that they were the ones who did it. They came up with a story as to why those burns occurred. Really didn't make a lot of sense, but the medical community really wasn't interested in making sense out of it. They wanted to treat them. And so in that case, the Minneapolis Police Department did not follow through with it. If we had caught them in the tunnel with Stavrol cutting through items, yes, absolutely, they could be charged for damage to property.
Representative Blatt, I'm guessing with as detailed an explanation of a voltage meter purchased at a hardware store, the padding, half inch into the wire, melted Salzol, that usually comes from some kind of an admission detailed in a police report, which is why I ask, and I'm presuming there's something in the way of an admission after the fact that was gleaned in the way of evidence. My second question is for the author, Representative Paymar. Is there a local impact note that you have with this?
Representative Paymar.
Are you asking, sir, if there's a fiscal note for this bill?
Yes.
No, there is not, Representative Rush.
Representative Rush, Mr. Chair, I have some issues with this, as have been stated, and I'm not sure if that means I'm voting yes or no on it yet. However, I'm glad to see Xcel Energy up here, and I was spoken with a representative of Quest earlier outside chambers. If I was a huge utility, I would absolutely love for the police to be more available to protect my property. And as I understand it, you own that property. I always want the police to protect my property. However, I also have a security system. I have locks on my doors. If I don't want anyone there, I have to post no trespassing. We enacted serious commercial and industrial property tax reform several years out, which you benefited greatly, and yet we're enacting something that puts more requirements in the way of arrests or prosecutions or charging, local court impact on a local level that is not reflected because there's no felony bed impact in the bill. And I think to myself, it's Quest property, it's Xcel's property, why can't you guys pay to protect it, or pay to put locks on it, or pay to post the no trespassing signs, which I think is what this bill is mainly geared at avoiding having to do.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Chair. I'll answer that question for you. We do secure our facilities. We put locks on, we put cameras on, card readers, alarm systems. These underground vaults are a little bit different in terms of the type of conditions that we have. There really isn't any good security system for them. Regarding your question pertaining to the no trespassing signage, I go back to the commander's statement that there's so many inroads and connections with these things that somebody could get into one of our tunnels, even if we had a no trespassing sign on the manhole cover, they wouldn't see it. The other thing I would say is that in the dark confines of this, I don't know how good that would work. I mean, putting up some kind of a trespassing sign wouldn't be seen, probably.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Palmer.
Let me just be clear. I mean, it's not just Xcel, and Xcel is here testifying on behalf of the bill, but there, as was stated, there's 600 miles of underground tunnels in the city of St. Paul alone. There's no felony provision here. As I understand, there's only been two prosecutions in the last couple of years, and Commander Anderson, I just asked Commander Anderson to respond to one thing about how your hands are tied now if you get a call about someone who's in one of these tunnels.
Proceed, Commander Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Sherry. Under the current statute, we have no intention of assigning officers to go patrol these tunnels. I mean, there's a safety issue for us as well. But in the past, there's not a lot of arrests that are made on this. But when we have made the arrest, because of that posting requirement and not being able to show how these people actually got in there, and you know whether they may or may not have seen a sign if there was one, and we make the arrest, but in the end we're unable to charge them with anything because we can't prove that they were previously told not to be in there or that there was a sign that existed that they walked by and ignored.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just have one last question for any of the testifiers, and probably more for Commander Anderson. As I've been told, there are roughly two kinds of people who, maybe variations on the two, that go down in these utility tunnels. One is the mousers or spelunkers who go on to explore, and they're not that interested in doing any damage, but they wander around there, and they're generally credible people, not strong criminal records. And then there are those vandals who go on to either steal or vandalize the tunnels. Which of those two types do you think is more likely to stay away from those tunnels on account of this legislation?
Commander?
Mr. Chair, Representative Letch, I would think that the, as you call the mousers or the explorer type people, would be the ones who would be more likely to comply with this. On that note, it's important to note, during this investigation, while I was trying to understand who goes in there and what they're doing and what the extent of the tunnels are, I worked with a member of that community who came forward to offer information to the city because of their concern for what goes on down there. From what I've seen in there and from what this individual told me, it is actually some of these members of this explorer community, or however you would like to refer to them, they are the ones who have created and are creating these unauthorized accesses to go from one system to the other. So, and they may not be down there cutting power lines or communication lines, but they are doing damage and creating unauthorized accesses between the different systems.
Representative Cole?
Chair, I just want to compliment Representative Lesh on his newfound interest in the cost of the bills that we're passing out of this committee, the new crimes we're creating, etc. I'm going to attribute some of that to the arguments I made on the floor earlier. I wish I'd been a little more convincing when we were talking about a different bill that had passed out of this committee previously, but I share your concern. Thank you.
Representative Coles, I'm sure we'll have more chances to hear that argument. And, any further testimony? Anyone from the audience wish to testify either before or for or against this bill? Any other questions from the committee?
Chair, let me just say if Representative Lesh has some concerns, if there's some issues relating to fiscal costs, I mean, we could refer this to public safety finance.
Representative Lesh, is that your, would you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I received a call from St. Paul Police Chief this morning. I always do what he tells me, so no, I'm not going to make any more of a stink. So, no, I don't need to refer to that.
Thank you, Representative Lesh.
For my bill.
Yeah. Representative Paymar, I assume that you are ready to renew your motion in House File 3228, be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Paymar. Representative Benson, House File 3175. And while Representative Benson is getting settled, just a quick reminder to testifiers and some members to turn off your cell phones. We're getting a little bit of interference on the audio. So, Representative Benson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hello. Appreciate you getting the gender correct. No, just kidding. Representative Olin, would you like to move House File 3175 to have it before the committee? Representative Olin so moves. Representative Benson, welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm here to visit with you and hopefully convince you to support House File 3175, which has to do with a surprising problem with our legal system, in that certain kinds of crimes or attempted crimes are difficult to prosecute and do not carry what I and we believe are sufficient penalties. And because the time is short and my committee will be in this room next, I think what I would like to do at this moment is to introduce two presenters that I have with me, Monica McIntosh, who will describe the situation that led to the production of this particular bill, and then also David Brown, who is assistant Hennepin County attorney, who will discuss the issues concerning the legal ramifications of this particular bill. And so with that, I will turn it over to Monica.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Benson, Ms. McIntosh, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Monica McIntosh, and the incident happened on the freeways that we all drive from Minnetonka to St. Paul on 94, a couple of Julys ago. A man tried to ram my car, run me off the road. He pinned me on the shoulder. He then proceeded to get out and come to my driver's side window 3 inches from my face, screaming obscenities, trying to break the window, trying to get into my car, and apparently the troopers were chasing behind him, but were nowhere around at this time.
Mm-hmm.
He luckily couldn't get in my car, went around to the front, tore off the medallion, threw it at the windshield, trying to break it, then went back to his car. At this point, I didn't know if he was going for a gun, a bat, or will take that car and ram it into me. I had no idea how this happened out of the blue on the freeway. With, to me, in my opinion, a simple twist of fate here, that my doors were locked, that I had a cell phone to call 911, and that there weren't other cars that I ran into on the freeway. He drove away, but that's the only reason I'm here today to talk to you, because I'm positive he would have thrown me out on that highway had he been able to get my car. I went to court every time that this was to be heard. I don't have the exact days that this man actually ended up serving in the county jail, I believe, but it was maybe 60. He was out 2 days after the sentencing. And I couldn't believe that what the penalty we had on the book was what we had on the book for a crime that could have killed me, as well as my daughter or any other person that was on the highway that day during this. So, hence why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McIntosh, for telling the story. Mr. Brown, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I've been a prosecutor for approximately 20 years. Our office is here in support of this bill. In most crimes, most felonies, we judge in the law the severity of it by the harm that gets done. And in most cases, that's true. And that makes sense. But in a robbery such as Ms. McIntosh suffered, or an attempted robbery, the harm gets done when the man's attacking you and trying to break into your car, not whether he gets a nickel from you, or a dollar from you, or $1,000 from you. The harm, the fear, the crime really happens when that event happens, not the amount of money they actually get away from you. What this bill does is make an attempted robbery the same as the completed crime. That is, it shouldn't matter, we shouldn't have half of the penalty because he didn't get a nickel from you. The other part of the bill recognizes, based on Ms. McIntosh's experience, and the reason I think she's brought this forward, is that when you do something in a car, it increases the dangerousness.
the victim, when they are in a car, is in a closed space. Their ability to get away, to run away, to get out of that is limited. They're pinned in. Also, when you're dealing with the victim in the car, you're endangering the public in a way that you wouldn't if they were on foot. You're putting them out in danger, pedestrians, other motorists, and so this bill reflects that. And so I certainly applaud Ms. McIntosh's courage for being here, for speaking to you. I want to thank Representative Benson for bringing this forward. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can somebody tell me what the penalty is for committing or attempting to commit a robbery in a person's home?
Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, Ms. McIntosh and I had this discussion beforehand, and many people mistake the two. In a home, in the law, it's called a burglary. And that, once you go in with the intent to do that, and that's punished differently than robberies. When you go into somebody's home, it's actually punished differently. Although we all think of it as a robbery, in fact, in the law, that is a burglary.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, then what is the penalty for burglary in somebody's home when they're there?
Mr. Brown? Cecilia?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, if the building is a dwelling and another person is in it, the maximum penalty is 20 years.
And Mr. Chair, is that a felony?
Of course.
Ms. Okay.
Okay.
It's not just a felony, it's a felony that presumes you go to prison. And that recognizes that the real harm happens once they get into the home, that the fear gets caused once they get in the home. And I know that's been of great concern to many people. But this is a robbery happening out on the street in somebody's car particularly. But aggravated robbery and simple robbery is a store clerk. You put a gun to their face but don't get anything. You don't take a candy bar. It's attempted robbery and it's half the penalty. And this recognizes that the harm in that situation happens when they put the gun up, or in Ms. McIntosh's case, when he's at the window trying to break in, not because they actually completed the crime. And that's all that's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the route of this bill? Where does it go from here?
I believe, Representative Smith, that we will be, if it does pass this committee, will be referred to finance with a recommendation to go to public safety finance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. One question of the author. Representative, have you sought out or have you received input from the public defenders?
Representative Benson.
This is a companion bill from the Senate. It is going to be heard in the Senate, and my communication has been with Mr. Brown.
So, Mr.
Representative Smith.
Chairman, then you have not sought out the opinion of the public defenders on this bill?
Representative Benson.
We have not, no, other than Mr. Brown, who is a public defender here, of course. Or not a public defender, but a prosecutor. We have not listed the public defender.
Thank you, Representative.
No, that's all. Thanks. Hopefully, I might add, hopefully, if this passes out of this committee, we will be able to pursue that and get that input from the public defender's office.
I would agree with, I think, the implied suggestion from Representative Smith that input would be very helpful as we're bringing more folks into the legal system in a more serious way. And
right.
I know that they're happy to chime in on issues that affect their office and their budget. So.
Particularly reasonable or not, to be done.
Anyone else, any other members with questions? Representative Weston.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer my support for this, and I agree with the testifier. About 8 years ago, I used to stay at the Kelly Inn when I was first elected, 10 years ago, I guess. And one weekend, I was going to be gone, and my sister had come down to meet a friend from Fargo. She lived down by Rochester, and they were going to meet, and I said, yeah, you can use my room to stay over. And about midnight, somebody shows up at the door and says, room service. And by the time they got to the door and said, we didn't call for room service, the door was kicked in. And they tried to steal stuff, and pulled a knife on her friend. And so I just share that because to this day, she still can't look over her shoulder. When somebody's following her, it's a terrible feeling that you can't get rid of. And so I think it's time to stiffen this stuff up. It's the attempts that we need to stop, because if the attempt doesn't happen, the robbery doesn't either.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We needn't go into too much detail, but this is not the first incident for you to have experienced something like this. You might just tell the committee how the cumulative effect of these instances have been for you personally.
Ms. McIntosh.
Thank you. Yes, I've been told a re-injury is almost even worse than the first. I was violently assaulted when I was 19, which it took thousands of dollars of therapy, several self-defense courses to regain a sense of security. Once this happened, and this is something I have to do every day, is drive. I've had to work through it all over again. So it has been very traumatic, and I believe the proactiveness of trying to do something about it in this way is part of my recovery and why I am here today.
Thank you. Any further questions, comments from the committee? And Representative Olin will renew his motion that House File 3175 be recommended to pass and referred to finance with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed, same sign. The motion carries. The bill passes. Thank you, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next one we're going to do is number House File 1262, Representative Mahoney. What we're going to do is have about 12 minutes for each side and then about 14 minutes for discussion, and then we'll have, after the 12 minutes on each side, we'll Representative Mahoney will decide who is on his, and then we have some lists. If the people that are opposing it could gather up in that corner that want to speak and decide which ones want to get their time in, and then we'll have about a minute on each side from the audience afterwards, with 230 seconds on each side. So, Representative Mahoney, you're basically, you control the first part.
So,
go ahead. Will somebody move Representative Mahoney's bill?
So moved.
Representative Lesh moves Representative Mahoney's bill. So, Representative Mahoney, go ahead and present your bill and witnesses.
Mr. Chair, just so I understand exactly, I have about 12 minutes for the bill and the testimony.
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 1262 has been seen a number of times. This is the sixth bill that I've carried like this, and generally it's died in the Senate. What House File 1262 does is changes the presumption of custody. I will go through the bill, but I'm sure most of you have given it a slight glance. This bill creates a presumption of joint physical and legal custody, requiring the use of parenting plans and modifying the custody designation in the parenting plan. I'll be fairly brief because I have to meet another committee. I'll just run through the bill this way. On page 1, line 18, we start with the, or 17, it starts with the joint physical custody. Means that the routine daily care and control and the residence of the child is structured between the parties. Important part here to this is that the joint physical custody does not require an equal or nearly equal division of the time between parties. In essence, that means that joint custody is not a 50-50 split. Not a 3.5 day, 3.5 day. It can be 20, 80, it can be 40, 60. Mr. Chair and committee members, we left in place current law with the 13 factors that are considered. The best interest of the child, the wishes of the child's parents, reasons of preference, child's primary caregiver. Number 12, the effect of the child on the child of the actions of an abuser, if related to the domestic abuse, is still in here. Mr. Chair and members, I have to say that what's been said about this bill is a little over the top, because I've been called an enabler of abusers. I've been told that I've had my fellow colleagues told that I support people abusing women. I am absolutely infuriated at this. I have three sisters. I have two daughters. Strong advocates of women, these two young women are. And I have a fiance. And I want this committee to know, and anyone that's talked about this bill, to know that I'm offended by that particular part of the bill, part of the advocate opposition to this bill.
Okay.
As you continue down, the part that becomes, to me, makes the most sense in this bill. If these 13 issues are met, and the court still chooses to make a reason not to allow joint physical custody, the court must make a detailed finding regarding the rationale for a deviation from the rebuttal of presumption in subdivision 2. Again, members, I haven't changed any of the reasoning for determining custody. A judge would have the ability to say, no, this is not a good situation. Subdivision 2 factors it puts into place the rebuttable presumption in child custody disputes. Deletes the language down to the new A and puts in the court shall use the rebuttable presumption that joint legal and physical custody is in the best interest of the child, notwithstanding paragraph A. The court shall use the rebuttable presumption that joint legal or physical custody is not the best interest of the child if domestic abuse, as defined in section 518B.01, has occurred between the parent, and adding in this language, or by a parent against the child who is the subject of the matter before the court. Section 4 calls for the court. The court shall adopt the parenting plan proposed by both parents. And if both parents do not agree to a parenting plan, they shall create a parenting order. Unless the court makes detailed findings that use of a parenting plan is not feasible. In essence, it creates a vehicle for the court to still be involved and give direction on how a child should be parented by two parents. That's in essence the bill. I had 8 or 9 testifiers. I will call down 3, and I will tell them to be brief. But Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Molly Olson down to speak about this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I have questions of the author. Do you want us to wait till after the presentation?
Yes, we want to give him a chance, not use up his time.
Very good, thank you.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, my name is Molly Olson. I'm a resident of Little Canada. I'm here as a volunteer to support the presumption of joint physical custody. I'm here to support H.S. 1262 as a first step to the right direction to equity in family court that will protect the rights of children. I'm here on behalf of the Center for Parental Responsibility, known as CPR. I'm the founder of this nonprofit organization, which serves over 1,000 Minnesota citizens interested in family law reform, and our numbers are growing every day. Our mission is to remove the obstacles that prevent both parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children. Who could ever imagine that our mission to ensure that children have equal access to both of their fit-loving parents would be so controversial? It makes no sense. Ensuring children have equal access to both fit-loving parents who want to fully participate in their lives should be a no-brainer. But our laws and our courts, and clearly by the looks of our opposition, attorneys and other government officials, are preventing a child's right to equal access to a fit, loving father who has done nothing wrong in the eyes of the law except agree to the involuntary divorce on demand that is initiated by the women nearly 80% of the time. Currently in our system, drug-addicted prostitute mothers have been convicted of neglect to their children, have a government child protection agency ready, willing, and able to help them turn their life around and make them a better parent to regain custody. But in family court, with the current law, a dad gets instantaneously stripped of custody with a stroke of a judge's pen because the custody evaluator said the wallpaper in his kid's room hadn't been updated or the parents can't cooperate. Almost everyone knows that game. The phrase, parents can't cooperate, is code for mom wants full custody and saying they can't cooperate will give her a slam dunk order in her favor. In these cases, the kids are used as weapons against the father. Without a statutory prevention of physical custody, we continue to destroy our society one child at a time. But our current family law policy, which systematically removes fathers from the lives of their children like a widget on a factory line with no human care or concern for the short-term impact or long-term outcome on these children. Why is this done? Because that's the way it's always been done? Because that's the way our society did things 35 years ago? Because that's the way lawyers ran it? 35 years ago, we began no-fault divorce. However, 35 years later, we still continue a fault-based custody model to support a divorce industry that forces the system to determine who is the better parent so the family court can divide the children like a stick of furniture that can only reside in one place. The so-called best interest criteria is so subjective that the decision can swing any way that's needed to fulfill the personal bias of the custody evaluator or the intentions of the judge or maintain the status quo. Depending on the research, 85 to 95% of the cases, mothers get sole physical custody and dads are stripped of custody and limited to seeing their kids every other weekend, only 4 days a month. Someone told me once, the best way to determine whether there's discrimination is to reverse the world. And if it feels uncomfortable, it's probably discrimination. So I ask you, if the roles were reversed and we gave dads full physical custody 85 to 95% of the time and limited mom to every other weekend, would that seem like you have a problem? Parent laws are not just segregating fathers to the back of the bus, we're booting them off the family bus. And for the sake of our children, this must stop. You probably place the burden on the judges to do the right thing, but you know what? I've heard judges blame the legislature, and say the law makes us do this. The current model promotes conflict. The current model is not working, so the Minnesota citizens ask you to ensure a statute that is abundantly clear, and the only sound constitutional decision is equal shared parenting, unless there are signs of abuse, harm, neglect, or abandonment according to a legally sound evidentiary standard. If you're truly worried about domestic violence, stripping a child of a fit, loving father for no reason is the worst form of child abuse there is. But currently, that abuse is sanctioned by statute. And we can't overlook the well-known fact that the extent to which false allegations of abuse are used by women routinely to gain an advantage in custody. The domestic violence industry may be trying to persuade you here and behind closed doors that physical custody will increase abuse. All the research says the opposite is true. The domestic violence paid advocates neglect to tell you the true fact that perpetrators of abuse are equally as much women as men also. Joint physical custody will reduce domestic violence because it distributes the power equally between two fit-loving parents.
because the primary cause of domestic violence is a feeling of powerlessness. I ask you, does the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution apply to the fit mom and the fit dad, or just the fit mom? Our legal counsel finds that in the absence of an actual finding of unfitness, a court order based on the non-custodial custodial model that we currently use operates in violation of the constitutional right of each parent. As citizens, we expect our legislators to protect citizens against the government and enact laws that effectuate the Constitution. All those opposing the bill here today are getting paid to be here. It's their job. All of us here supporting the bill today, and we have 14 of us that aren't going to get to talk. All of us are unpaid, and we've had to take vacation time to be here. We have no paid lobbyists, but we're here because we want to fight for children for generations to come. The citizens are asking you, the legislature, to protect the fundamental rights of parents and children and pass to prevent them from joint physical custody. And we have a handout for everyone.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, you've got about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I'll give you about a minute extra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I have an attorney, Joe Field. And I'll tell him to be as safe as possible.
Thank you. Do you want to have your other witness to come down? Be ready.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. If Tim Hall could step down to be ready in case there's time left.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Not Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Field.
Proceed?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Field. I'm an attorney, and I practice in family law. I've been doing so for about 15 years. I practice primarily in Anoka, although I have practiced in the Midway area of St. Paul for a number of years. I'm here today to speak in favor of proposed legislation. I came here today because I practice in this very difficult field. There's a lot of conflict in family law, and boy, if you talk to family law attorneys, a lot of them, they can't hang around that practice too long. And the reason for it is usually because of custody issues. I believe that what you have before you is a bill that will reduce conflict for children in as much as no-fault divorce reduce conflict for spouses. This is key. This is a pivotal bill that children need, but also the spouses. And here's what I'm going to do. I get people in my office a lot at wanting joint physical custody. And it's amazing to me what goes on, the expressions that I see in their faces when I have to explain to them the existing law. And what I'm going to describe to you is just what I observe with new clients. What I do observe when I have, sometimes I have both of them come in to see me and I have waivers and all that, but I have them come in, they say, we want to get a divorce and we want to have shared custody, joint physical. So what I observe is that the married couples who come in, that they have accepted or at least acknowledged the inevitability of their divorce occurring in the relationship. And I observe for the most part that they have concern, their face expresses concern about their future. And sometimes they have a relief, their faces show relief that a divorce is coming. But when those couples express to me their desire to share custody equally, I see the following as I explain to them the present law. At first, after I explain to them what the present law states regarding joint physical custody, the presumption against it, it's not so much what I see, but what I hear. And what I hear from them is silence. They just stare back at me, neither one speaking, trying to comprehend the significance of me telling them that a judge will generally deny joint physical custody unless the parties go out of their way to leave the judge to determine otherwise. Once the effect of my answer wears off, I hear from them a question, almost universal from those seeking to retain my services. The question is this, but why? But why is there a presumption against joint physical custody? This doesn't make sense, they tell me. We have raised our kids together. We have a good relationship with our children. We don't want to hurt them by the divorce process. Those are their questions. You see, they view their offer of shared custody as a normal outcome, sometimes even virtuous. But my response to them, and it sometimes elicits a small nervous laugh, is I tell them, and I have no other explanation but this, I tell them, welcome to planet Mars. Because the legislation makes no sense. My understanding is a majority of the other states in the country have some sort of shared or joint physical custody plan in place. You guys would probably know that better by your researchers. But I tell them, welcome to Planet Mars, and I explain that the law has been justified for years because lawmakers accepted the argument that children should primarily reside with one parent, and because that affords the child consistency and stability. But I also tell them what apparently went unnoticed by lawmakers was that such a shared parenting schedule most closely approximates the relationship that children had with their parents prior to the divorce. The children liked that. That such a shared parenting schedule reduces control issues as the parenting schedule typically exercised by the sole custodial parent. There's a lot of post-degree fights, and I'll tell you, judges would really love it if they didn't have to deal with that, and you would eliminate that with joint physical custody. I also told them that such a schedule allows the children to continue to experience both female and male role models, as opposed to the current formula, which leaves non-custodial fathers as Disneyland dads due to their heartfelt inclination to entertain their seldom-seen children, because the set structures, limits, and disciplines may be taken as unduly harsh to their children. I tell them that lawmakers must have overlooked how the additional freed-up time for the parents may enable them to go to school further, for the parents to be trained in another occupation, in some cases to devote themselves to building a new family. Welcome to Planet Mars, I tell them. The present law doesn't make common sense. It's tough to understand. And then they ask me, what can we do then? And I tell them, you can try it. You will most likely be referred by the court to a joint physical custody assessment, and then the court will give significant weight to that assessment's conclusions. The problem, I tell them, is that for the most part, and there are exceptions, that the joint physical custody assessment evaluators speak Martian too. The whole system is greatly influenced by the current law. As this couple gets up to leave my office to think things over, I can see that the hope of a new life free from the stress and contention...
Representative Mahoney, you're all for 5 minutes already, so we have to...
That's fine.
Try to wrap it up really quick.
Three sentences to finish, and then we'll be done.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So anyway, free from the stress and contention with movements towards divorce now appears to be even greater on their faces. Their movements are slow, and their faces downcast. They realize that they must now draw their swords and battle in a winner-take-all custody fight, and the children stand by, not knowing of the likelihood of them being victims of friendly fire. Children suffer in such a fight that could have been avoided but for a change in the present law.
Representative Mahoney, could you have your third witness do it in less than a minute, possibly?
Actually, Mr. Chair, let's just move on.
Okay.
What I will tell you is that I had a guardian ad litem. I had one, two, three fathers, one grandmother, one grandmother, one set of grandparents. I have a stepmother here. I have a couple of other fathers. This is an issue that we need to address, and we cannot continue to just kill this bill. I will stand for questions or the opponents to this particular bill.
Representative Mahoney, giving equal time is not attempting to kill the bill. Representative Lush, we were going to take both sides and then have questions. Is there a reason not to do that? Or? Okay.
As long as the testifiers are
going to
be here for that.
Oh, I'm Representative Mahoney, and the testifiers will stay around for questions. We have six listed for the other side, so do they want to come up? I believe it's Liz Richards, Melinda Hugdahl, Jerry Williams, Nancy Versteed, Clint Norton, and Mark. You know, and unless you can agree differently, we'll allow 2 minutes for each. Joel Olson came in late. I guess that we'll give about a minute to that. Ms. Richards? And Representative Mahoney, I didn't want to interrupt your time, but I can't apologize for other people, but I heard that in the hall too today that you were doing something to creating battered women, and I just told everyone that I had practiced a lot of family law for 12 years, and that definitely I was contrary to my beliefs, even though I don't support your bill, but think it was outrageous, the things that were said about you, so. Ms. Richards, you're becoming a regular.
That's for sure.
Ms. Richards, go ahead.
Just in terms of management of time, myself and Linda Hugdell from Legal Services will do some introductory stuff. Then Nancy Versteeg actually had to leave. She's from William Mitchell College of Law. And then the Department of Human Services will be testifying, and I believe a couple other very short pieces. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. The Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women has over 90 programs located throughout the state that serve battered women and their families. And indeed, we are testifying in opposition to this bill. And the reason why we are testifying in opposition is because we believe that it creates harm. And it creates harm in a number of ways. And I'm just going to briefly go through those. And people who follow me will be filling in more of the details. Joint custody is not best for all children. And when joint custody is chosen by parents, it can be very beneficial. And under our current system, we have a presumption of joint legal custody already on the books. We also have a system that allows parents to come in and do parenting plans. We have a system that allows for joint custody in those cases where the parents come in and choose that. And it can be very beneficial. What research has shown is that when joint custody is not chosen, but rather is imposed upon parties, that is when it can have detrimental impact on children in terms of their ability to adjust to the divorce and the problems that go ongoing. We also know that joint custody is particularly bad when domestic violence is present within a family. That we know that battered women continue to experience abuse even after they leave a relationship, even after a divorce. And joint custody arrangements increase the level of contact between the parents and exposes battered mothers to the potential for ongoing threats and abuse. One example, there's a study done in Canada where 25% of the mothers who are using safety exchange centers experience direct threats of abuse. The abuse goes on long after divorces end. So in cases where there's domestic violence, there's increased potentials of risk. And when you go into a joint custody situation, you're increasing the level of contact between the parents and also those harms as well. The other thing we know is that joint custody legislation does not decrease conflict. That now, while there are a few empirical studies looking at this issue, there are some. And what those studies are saying is that it doesn't have, at best, it has no impact on the amount of litigation that goes on, and that it may actually increase the amount of litigation when you move towards joint custody statutes. And I believe Melinda's going to talk more directly about that. In considering any changes to the custody laws, you must consider the impact that those law changes are going to have on battered women and their children. We know that battering and child abuse are present in a significant number of divorce cases, and we know that the cases that are the most drawn out, the most contentious, those that are often referred to as high conflict cases, we know that in those cases there's a significant percentage of domestic violence present. And one of the things, I think there was a little confusion in terms of how this bill was presented. In my read of this bill, you've taken out some of the specific factors to be looked at when looking at joint custody. In terms of, there's a removal of the statutory factors that currently exist in our custody law that say the court is to consider the party's ability to communicate, what is their dispute resolution mechanisms, and to look at domestic abuse. And that's in the joint legal custody factors. To remove those things from the statute is very dangerous. Custody and parenting time planning should treat security of the children as a top guiding principle. This is not about access. This is not about mom's rights to have access to her kids. It's not about dad's right to have access to the kids. What this should be about is what is truly in the best interest of children. What is best for this family should be guided by what is best for the children. When domestic abuse is present in a family, what we know is that a child's sense of security is a critical factor in their resiliency to be able to overcome domestic violence. And there's a whole body of research that's been done here in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota, Jeff Edelson being the primary researcher, showing that the resiliency of children is directly linked to the safety of their mothers. And it should be considered when making these decisions in the court. Now, I know that everyone on this committee has heard the individual stories of people who have gone through divorce processes. These are powerful stories. We have all heard the stories of horrible divorces dragged out over long periods of time, taking incredible amounts of money, one parent not being able to see their children. We at the Coalition for Battered Women have heard those stories as well. We've heard them countless times. There are a number of women here who are today who would love to tell the committee their stories. It's a story of having been battered in a relationship, having gotten the courage to leave that relationship, only to find themselves having to be embroiled with an abusive ex-husband in custody battles. And that oftentimes that the children end up becoming a tool of continued abuse. It's a story of abusive fathers who too often gain custody of their children and exclude mothers from their children's lives. While the statistics may well show that mothers gain custody more often than fathers, what the statistics show is that when fathers request custody, they're more likely to gain custody, and that abusive fathers request custody more frequently than non-abusive fathers, and that when abusive fathers ask for custody, they are more likely to get sole or joint custody of those children than others. So it's important to look at what the statistics really say. And too often when abusive fathers gain custody, the abuse gets turned on to the children. Now, while these individual stories, the stories of fathers and the stories of battered mothers, are very compelling, they are not the basis to make a change in the joint custody presumption statute. Hopefully what these stories are is they indicate we have a family court system that has enormous problems. Our current system is not doing a good job for families. But the solution is not to adopt a joint custody presumption. What MCBW would propose is that we take a step back, that we take a comprehensive look at our family court system, we identify and understand the problems that are there, that we look at empirical data, we look at alternative models that are being used around the country. We need to find solutions that are adequate and appropriately address all the problems in family court. So we would ask you not to pass House File 1262. The joint custody presumption will only add to the problems that already exist within the family court system. We need a more reasoned and thoughtful approach for comprehensive reform. Thank you.
Ms. Hudgall, it's my understanding that it's agreed that you two will take up almost all the time. Is that...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we will probably use a bulk of the time. I'm going to try and be as brief as I possibly can so we make sure. I know there's someone here from the Department of Human Services as well, so we want to make sure that we give people a few minutes at least. About how much time, Mr. Chair, would you...
You've got about 7 minutes.
Okay, I'll try and do it in less than that.
Well, that's for the whole, however...
For everybody. Okay, then I will be very brief. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is Melinda Hugdahl. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. We have legal aid offices statewide. Almost all of them do family law. We represent both mothers and fathers in family court cases. And as I said, we do have offices across the street. We are deeply concerned about this bill. We recognize and we appreciate we represent parents in court proceedings, so the rights and interests of parents are important. But our first priority should always be about protecting children. And I think our really fundamental philosophical difference on this bill is what the role of a presumption is and what it does to the process of family court. And our concern is that when you put a presumption in place, it really restricts significantly the ability of the court to look at individual families and individual situations, because there's a presumption there and a presumption that is what it is unless or until someone else comes forward. That's just the nature of a presumption. Family court cases are incredibly diverse. Parents can be married to each other. They may not be married to each other. They may have had a long-term relationship, or they may have known each other a very short time. This presumption would apply not to just dissolutions, but also to paternity cases. There may be children of various ages. Some of them may be teenagers. Some of them may be infants. And so they can have a variety of different needs. Courts need to be able to have that ability to make decisions that are best for that family and that child. If there's a presumption adopted, judges are going to start with an answer, that there's a presumption of joint physical custody, and that's workable. That's what a presumption is. It's going to really reduce the court's need or reliance to go to look at those best interest factors, to look at what's the best interest of each of those children. because if no one challenges it, that is the result. It is a joint physical custody situation. Studies have shown this one-size-fits-all approach is not workable for a lot of families, and in cases with a lot of conflict can actually be very detrimental to children. There are also diverse families are in their level of conflict. Some parents have very little conflict, and they resolve their issues between them. And the law currently allows those parents to do that. And we encourage that. Where there's not conflict and they can work together and cooperate, they should absolutely be co-parenting, and those kids should be involved with both of their parents as much as possible. Under current law, the primary factor they're looking at is the cooperation of the parents. And that really has a lot of correlation to the level of conflict children are exposed to, how much they're able to talk to each other. Children, as they get older, as many of you know, their needs change, their schedules change. Parents need to be able to work together, especially if they're having a joint custody situation. So we're deeply concerned about eliminating the ability to cooperate from the best interest factors in the statute that's deleted in this bill. We're concerned this bill will actually increase and not reduce conflict. Under current law, there's no presumption in the statutes of a presumption in favor of either parent. The court looks at the best interest factors individually and makes findings within its judgment decree. If parents, however, initially think there's a presumption of a presumed answer, we're concerned it might actually increase litigation by them feeling the need to file more affidavits and more allegations about the other parent to come forward to overcome that presumption. That is our concern, is that's raising that level of conflict. We're also concerned because the commonly used definition, both in the case law of the courts and everyday people involved in the process, is joint physical custody means equal time. And I appreciate that that's not what the bill currently says. There's a sentence in there that says it doesn't mean equal time. However, we're concerned that if this bill were to pass, there's still the issue of parenting time that needs to be resolved. And the motions that are going to come forward are going to be for equal time. That's what people commonly understand. We have a very high unrepresented litigant rate in Minnesota, and we're going to have a significant number of these cases coming forward. And those issues are linked in people's minds, that equal time and joint physical custody, and that's our concern. And we're concerned that if that happens and starts the ball rolling, this may become an equal time presumption, even if that's not the original intent of the legislation. It's been the experience of other states that when statutes have been changed to strongly encourage joint custody, post-judgment motions have nearly doubled. And that is very concerning to us, especially with low-income people with limited resources to be able to use already very limited resources. We're concerned about impacts in other areas of the law. If you have both parents now being custodial parents, that has impacts in other areas. For example, in juvenile cases, whether you are a party or whether you're entitled to a public defender depends upon the custodial parent. If both are now custodial, you are significantly extending the roles of the public defenders, in our opinion. They would have to represent both parents. I'm trying to wrap up very quickly.
Ms. Huggall, if you're going to have any time for DHS, you're going to have to wrap up. And whoever is from DHS, would you come down?
Yes.
Because you've given them 1 minute. To
okay.
I'll let go a little bit extra. Go ahead. Is this Ms. Martineau?
My name is Jill Olson, and I'm from the Department of Human Services, the Child Support Division.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today not to oppose or propose this legislation. I'm just here to bring up the concerns the department has regarding the effects of this bill on child support specifically. And the two concerns that this bill raises is, first, it makes calculating child support under the current child support guidelines more difficult, more confusing, and possibly impossible in some cases. And the specific language that causes these problems is the proposed language that states that joint physical custody does not require an equal or nearly equal division of parenting time between parties, and the language that allows the court not to make a parenting time order if it's determined not to be feasible. In cases where the parties are ordered to have joint physical custody and there's no order for parenting time, the department has no way to calculate child support, which is concerning. In addition, this bill causes problems in the area of interstate cases, and these problems arise when state of Minnesota order that is registered for enforcement and modification in Minnesota, or in a different, from Minnesota that's registered for enforcement and modification in a different state. That state, if they see that it's been a joint custody determination, the way the child support checklist will be based on their laws, and their laws might mean equal parenting time. And so there's concerns in that regard as well, and that those child support orders might not accurately reflect the actual circumstances of the parties.
Thank you, Ms. Martineau. And Ms. Olson, sorry about that. And basically the time is up now for each side, so now we would go to questions, and Representative Smith, you're first. It's Smith/Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. What others, how many other states have this presumption that you are proposing in this bill?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I didn't bother to check what other states are doing. I'm only worried about what we're doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, are you aware of any other state that has such a presumption?
I believe there have been some other states that have put this into law. I'm not sure at the present time what other in other states' law are.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is going to Public Safety Finance from here, is that correct?
Yes, Representative.
I have no further questions now.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably for maybe health research staff, and they can, but Representative Simon leaned over to me and asked me about joint legal and when that was enacted in Minnesota, and Representative Paymar, though, has the book, so maybe I could just ask him. He stole the book.
Mr. Gary, Representative Paymar is dangerous trying to interpret law, so we'll let Mr. Gary do it.
Mr. Chair, you'll have to give me a few minutes to look it up and find
out.
Can
we come back to your question, Representative Lesch? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, having been through a messy divorce with children, I'm going to qualify myself as an expert on the issue. Representative Mahoney, I like your bill. I don't like the way that the women that were just up here dumped on dads. I heard abusive fathers mentioned about 50 times.
There's nothing, no responses are allowed to be removed from the room if we have that. That just isn't allowed in committee or on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, you noticed that Representative Mahoney came up with his witnesses, and he was very fair. He talked about men, women, husbands, wives. And then the women came up there, and they talked. They said abusive fathers about 20 times. And then they brought up the deal about needs and made it look like a woman is in better shape to take care of the needs of the children. Then DHS comes up here. This is an example of how loaded this system is against fathers in this whole state. Having been through this system, you come in and they've got advocates sitting there that automatically brand you as somebody that can't take care of the child's needs, or that the woman is automatically more prepared to take care of her needs, or that you're abusive father. And it's just loaded. We'd have to do something with this bill to change this, and I think you just saw an example. It's just completely loaded. And I don't care if it's tough for DHS to calculate, that's your job. If this bill makes it tougher to calculate, you should see how it is for the father to calculate his checkbook.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney?
I don't think there's a question in there, Ed. To be honest, I'm not out here trying to blame or beat up on anyone. I really am trying to come up with a system that allows the non-custodial parent to instill their idea of what a child should grow to be. And I don't care whether it's a religious value or a moral value or educational value or anything else. But I know way too many people whose values have been discarded because of the way the law is written in this state. What, Mr. Chair, I know my colleague, the chair of the Public Safety Finance, has an amendment. We've discussed it. I'm more than willing to accept that particular amendment if he's interested in presenting it at this time. We have some work to do on it before it gets to his committee. I've now missed the premier bill for me this year, the bioscience bill over in the bonding committee at this particular time. But so I think it needs this particular hearing needs to end, and if the chair of the Public Safety Finance is willing to offer the amendment. We'll work on this at a later time.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. I just wanted to comment on the Ms. Olson's talk. I actually attended meetings on this topic between the courts and in Hennepin County and the Bar Association, and there's just incredible number of issues that arise no matter what we do on this. And so I was going to suggest exactly what, not exactly, but something on the order of what Representative Paymar is doing, because they found over, I think it's over 180 cross-references that we'd have to change things in the law if we just did anything on it right now. And I think if Representative Paymar is going to move that, I'm really happy that Representative Mahoney is moving to what I think is a really good resolution.
Mr. Chair, after 6 years of having the court tell me they're working on this, and we'll be back to you next year. Understand, unless it goes into law, and I trust my colleague over there, I don't have a lot of trust in the court system.
And Representative Mahoney, I understand your position, and I think this is good to give them a date that they have to come up with something by. Representative Paymer, are you going to move for the DE-1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move the DE-1 amendment. I've discussed this with Representative Mahoney, and I have promised him that I would we would consider some language that he would like to tighten this up. Representative Cole has some language that he would like inserted, and I've got the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I think they'd have some language, but I think we can reach some common ground here, and Janet Marshall from the court is apprised of what we're doing, and she's okay with it. So basically what we're doing is asking the Supreme Court to convene a study group to conduct an evaluation of the family court processes in Minnesota, and I think this is long overdue, and I think the testimony that we've heard backs that up, and I believe that this is a compromise, and that's my amendment, Mr. Chair. I don't relish fighting with my St. Paul colleague every year on this bill, so maybe we can...
Representative
Elson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymer, in your amendment, as you're working on it, I hope that you'll ask that they report on the financial implications of whatever recommendations that they make as well.
Okay, is there Representative Cole?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Paymar and Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney, I'll share with you what I showed Representative Paymar, but I did ask that as we pull this language together, that we make sure that it's clear that this is at least one of the issues that needs to be considered by the group, this issue of joint legal and physical custody. I'm a little concerned that the language right now could be interpreted 6 months from now that type of, studying that issue isn't required. So I appreciate Representative Paymar's willingness to work on that. I'll give you the language that I penned together, but it's not appropriate to offer it right now because I'm not sure that it does exactly what we need to do.
Okay. Representative Weston?
The chair, question for the author, and then I actually had a question for one of the last witnesses, but just to the amendment. Representative Paymar, are you requiring any sort of absolute report or just a study that, what kind of meat do we have in this? Because I think this issue, not like the overweight permit issue, Mr. Chair, in the Transportation Committee, been around since I got here 12 years ago, and nothing seems to be done. What would substantively be able to come out of this, or is it going to just be like the K-12 education funding formula study groups that always come out with something that is not so...
Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, lines 110 through 112, and we can tighten this up also in public safety finance. says that the study group must report to the legislature on its recommendations for improving the efficiency, functionality, and accessibility of family court processes no later than February 15, 2009. So Mr. Mahoney wants to move that up to January, so we start the legislative session. I'm fine with tightening that up. I don't want this just to be a study that sits on a shelf. I want something concrete to happen out of this. And I have my commitment, and I will have some strong language in that.
And to that point, Mr. Chair, I would encourage you and Representative Mahoney to let's come up with something of substance, because I too hear too many times, and as you know, in this business, as a legislator, you know, balance, you often find both sides not real happy, or you don't hear from both neither side very often. I too gotta say I hear many, many more times from the side of the non-custodial parent. And it's not all men. I've got a good friend. She is just as frustrated with the system as other men are. So I hope you can stand strong on that, Representative Mahoney, and we can get something.
Representative Mahoney, I think you have proven that you're standing strong on this.
I'm not known to be real shy.
Representative Mahoney, this issue, we much more will agree on than the last one we've crossed.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I'm disappointed that you're going this route. I'm frustrated, too. I think there were some changes that could have made your bill better, but if this is the only way you've got to keep moving, I know how that works around here. But I would really fight that you've got all kinds of people, power groups listed as being involved in this, and then you have other interested parties are represented. I would look for language in this that you have representatives from advocacy groups, from non-custodial parents or whatever, to make sure that people that don't generally function in this environment, if you will, have an opportunity at the table and to be heard. And then I would also echo some of the comments about, spell out real specifically what you want them to comment on, because this is so broad that, I mean, it's just going to really cause a lot of people to waste time, actually, and we're not going to get what we need out of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, Representative Smith carried a bill that did a lot of good work. I worked on little pieces of it, and his did a lot of change to it. And I'm glad that we're giving it some time to work through the system. In the end, yes, I think this particular amendment, and my friend over there from the other representative from St. Paul, and I will be tightening this up. I don't really hope that we get a huge group. I don't think it needs 100 people in the room when we do this to come up with some better ideas on how we do it. And I hope to build on what Representative Smith has done a couple of years ago.
Representative Paymar, my understanding is you want to change your amendment to January 15th. Is that correct?
We can do it now, or we can wait to.
Well,
yeah,
let's
do it now. I would move that line 112, we strike February 15th and insert January.
All in favor of the amendment to the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay, the amendment BE1 is as amended is up, and just to represent Kaelin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to reiterate Representative Westrom's comments and others about the importance of putting some real weight to, we have a lot of studies. I've only been here a little over a year, and I see that we send a lot of studies out, we get some back, and I think in this case it will be really important. I'd like to see this issue come to some real resolution, because I know it has nearly a decade of history before today in the legislature. And so I have some thoughts. I don't think they're well enough formed to share them today, but before the bill comes to your committee, Representative Paymar, I'd like to share them with you about some ways that we can say that they must report, but maybe adding a consequence in there may help things along a little bit. So I'll share that with you privately about some ways that we could do that. I did want to comment to, I believe it was Representative Holbert, or I can't remember who it was on the comment before. I do think we need to spell out specifically one of the issues, that this being the core issue that sparks this study. I think it's a very good move, and I think expelling it out is important. But as you know, Representative Mahoney, my training in architecture taught me to be very wary about going to a very specific solution and not being open to all the possibilities of a creative solution down the road. What we do is we throw noodles at the wall and see what sticks, and most of the time nothing does, except for one or two possibilities. We don't know what might be able to resolve this issue. I did not support the specific language in 1262 as you brought it, for reasons that you and I have discussed, and I didn't, being a child of divorce, I didn't come to that position lightly. I did not have a good relationship with my father after our divorce. In fact, I didn't speak to him for 3 years. And now we have since come around, and he's probably my best friend. I think it's really, really important that we resolve this issue, but that we do so in a way that that actually doesn't create more problems. I take the issue of child support calculation to be very serious. And I think that we need to figure out all the variables here, and I appreciate both Representative Tomar and Mahoney coming together to be able to move us forward a little bit, and look forward to sharing my thoughts on how we can put some teeth into the deadline. Thank you.
Representative Kalin, I would just suggest that I know you're in law school now, and eventually to become a lawyer you have to become admitted to the bar, and you're talking about penalties on the Supreme Court to decide I don't know if you're going to take away their salary or what, but it might not help your application.
Sure, I'm far less concerned about the justices, and who I have great respect for, but far more concerned about those of us around
sometimes
the table.
Sometimes you're supposed to set the shovel down.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I take strong exception to Representative Kalin's thing, throw noodles against the wall and see what sticks out here. That's absolutely what we do. I think it works great. Although some people would say it's not noodles we throw at the wall. Nonetheless, sometimes that's why I have a problem, Representative Paymar, with your study. Big surprise. I don't like studies in general because I think people send us up here to do. We come here with our experiences, and we should come here with adequate information to make a decision to move forward in a certain direction. And so I generally do not like studies because I think it's a cop-out. Now, I understand many people see these as a compromise. And I do know, as I recall, Representative Mahoney talked about Representative Smith's bill 3 years ago, that I wasn't speaking a lot on the floor in my first couple years, but I stood up and I spoke on that one, and I remember it's because I was 3 months out of a divorce decree in my situation. And there are people, when the testifiers came up and said, everyone's heard horror stories, well, some of us have lived them. And I know for a fact that for me, it wasn't because I couldn't get along with my ex-wife. We had everything worked out, but it was the system and the lawyers who were able to hold us hostage to the letter of the law, to make things more difficult for us. I will never be over that, what happened in that situation, which is why I think something needs to be done. So I have great faith, Representative Paymar, that something will come of this, and I think deadlines are always good. And I also presume that Representative Mahoney has counted the votes, and this is the way we're going to move forward. So we'll leave it at that.
Members were way over the time. If you want to speak, can you cut it down quite a bit, Representative?
The chair can cut off debate.
Representative Mahoney, I know that I'm trying to suggest that they restrain themselves a little. Put a restraining order on themselves, maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney and Representative Paymar. I think the study is probably a good way to go. I'm not sure where this is going today. I actually have a lot more questions. I've heard both sides, you know, as best I can, you know, just in generalities. I've been kind of lucky. I'm still married. I got the 20-year pin, so you know, the kids are almost done, so I don't know. So far so good, but I haven't needed Emma yet.
His wife is.
And are you there for me?
Okay.
Fair enough. So I'm going to be happily married for quite a while. You know, some of the things that I've heard just, you know, scare me. You know, I mean, you think of, you know, as a parent, I've got three kids that I love dearly, and it just breaks my heart to think that, you know, 85% of the time, these are numbers I heard today, and then someone said something like 4 days a month that I would see my kids. I just can't even imagine. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, I might commit suicide or something. I mean, it would just kill you. There's a lot of questions. You know, I work at Northwest Airlines, and, you know, we all work. You know, a lot of different people are losing their jobs. You know, we hear about people that go through a divorce, and they don't refigure some of the money kind of issues and different things. So I hope that the study will look at that, and, you know, where one spouse makes a lot of money, you know, maybe a couple hundred thousand, the other spouse doesn't make much. So I hope you look at these things. On and on. I hear about judges being, you know, maybe aren't doing the best jobs, and referees. I've actually heard a referee's name a couple times, so hopefully you're looking at that. I don't work in the courts, so I don't have to be afraid of them, I guess, at this point. Unless Emmer, of course, Emmer's not going to be there to help me. But I hope we're looking at that, too, because if there is, you know, perhaps people in law in the court system that are not, you know, maybe do have a bias, hopefully we are kind of looking at that and trying to evaluate that. So I'm in favor of study, and thank you for compromising on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney and Representative Paymar. The one thing that I would ask is to, during the study, if this amendment does proceed, which I'm assuming it is, but I would like to know a lot more about the child support issue. That is the big question that I have about your bill. So if you could have that kind of be an integral part of the study, I would appreciate that, because I think it may answer some questions too.
Yeah. Okay. Chair is going to go ahead and call for the DE1 amendment is on the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Okay, now the House File 1262, Representative Paymar renews his motion, which I believe was to pass without recommendation and be referred to Finance.
Finance, with a re-referral to Public Safety.
With a
recommendation to Public Safety Finance.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, could we maybe just move this to the General Register and put it in the consent calendar?
All in favor of the Paymar motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Simon.
No. All those that
Representative Simon moved his bill 3331. Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The hour is late and attention spans are short, so I'll try to be short. Would you like me to move the bill,
Mr. Chair? I already said you moved the bill.
Okay. Then I do. Mr. Chair, I don't know how you'd like to proceed. I have an author's amendment, and maybe it might be best to put it on now, and I can explain it later.
Representative Simon, let us find the... An oral amendment?
No, it's an actual printed amendment. It's the A1 amendment.
30 minutes.
It's probably being passed out right now.
Yeah, I've got one for him.
Would the crowd be quiet? We are trying to conduct business in here. Thank you. Representative Simon, go ahead and describe the amendment.
Does everyone have a copy? I just want to make sure.
Well, just go ahead and describe it, and we'll...
Bill generally, Mr. Chair, and I'll get to the ins and outs.
You can describe the...
describe, is it an important part of the bill, or?
Well, I would say so, but my preference would be maybe we vote on it to get in the shape that I would prefer to
okay.
be in.
Okay, then describe the amendment while it's being handed out.
I hadn't seen it on
the... Well, okay, yeah, the amendment just adds a provision having to do with the facilitation of organized retail crime. And I can explain it in more detail when I explain the whole bill and how it fits in, but that's basically what it is. That's what the author's amendment is.
Okay, Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment to get it in this, is my understanding, to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Simon.
Members, thanks. I'll try to be quick, because we have a few tests.
The A1 to put it in the shape the author wants.
We have an A1, but... Yeah.
Okay, Representative Simon,
thanks,
go ahead.
Chair. Members, this is a bill to combat organized retail crime, which you may not have heard of, but it's a growing phenomenon. You should be getting right now some handouts which demonstrate that it's a problem, and some of the testifiers here will amplify that. But basically, if you look at the table right here, in a time when we had a bad budget forecast today, this is particularly important, I think. According to these statistics, we're losing out on about $40 million, just shy of $41 million in lost sales tax revenue every year because of this phenomenon. This is a new level and a new generation of the common shoplifting problem. This is not the teenager putting a DVD or a CD in his vest pocket. These are organized bands and gangs of people who methodically and systematically go often from city to city, from store to store, in high-end retail outlets, or any retail outlet, at least, really, stealing high-end items and then selling them or fencing them either over the Internet or elsewhere. And it's a big problem. If you go to the FBI website, of course, terrorism is front and center, naturally, but there's a link on the homepage of the FBI website to this problem, which is a multi-billion dollar problem. Another handout kind of describes the problem, a one-pager that says an introduction to organized retail crime, and then there's a local angle, another handout you have, the WCCOI team talking about e-fencing and organized retail crime. But you can read that for yourself. I'd like to hand it over to those who are on the front lines of this issue. And first, I'd like to hand it over to Mike Ward of Target Corporation, who I originally met. He wouldn't remember. He pretends to, but I don't think he really did. I was a law student, and I clerked at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and he used to be a federal prosecutor. But now he's with Target, and I'll turn it over to him.
Mr. Ward. Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I work with Target Corporation. I'm an attorney there.
Just somebody's got their cell phone going, and it's really disturbing things. Turn one of they said it's one of the. No? Okay, well, at least it's off now. Go ahead, Mr. Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm an attorney with Target Corporation. As Representative Simon said, prior to joining Target, I was a federal prosecutor here in Minneapolis for 16 years. So my experience comes not only from my work with our asset protection folks at Target, but also prosecuting the full range of federal criminal offenses. And so I want to commend the committee for taking up this issue, but also just give a couple of insights from a prosecutor as to how this problem has grown and how the bill, sponsored by Representative Simon and others, I think is going to make a great effect and help us address this problem. First of all, as Representative Simon said, this is a runaway problem. The FBI estimates that over $30 billion a year, that's billion dollars a year, is lost by retailers alone to organized retail crime. The large white board in front of you is a summary of just one of the organized retail schemes that our Target Corporation investigators have disrupted just in the last year. This one was centered in Woodbury, Minnesota, just east here of the capital, and it was a multi-million dollar operation. There's a bag being passed around. I think the members of the committee, this is what we call a booster bag. It's one of the many devices that these organized retail crime rings use to frustrate the efforts that retailers take to protect the merchandise. This is foil lined to protect anti-theft detection devices. Other perpetrators of this crime have been known to use emergency fire exits to carry out their crime. Target Corporation alone spends hundreds of millions of dollars to fight this problem, and we even have two forensic laboratories to try to assist law enforcement in this problem. But the reason that we need your help is that the scale and scope of this problem is outside even the reach of our law enforcement partners, who've been great to help us. Let me give you a little bit of scope of this problem here. Because people, as I know this from my experience in the U.S. Attorney's Office, people say, well, why don't we get the federal government to, you know, to take care of this problem? This sounds like a really big problem, and the federal government needs to address it. And I'm here to tell you that it's bigger than even the federal government. If you consider the fact that across the entire United States, all of the federal criminal cases prosecuted every year is never more than 60,000 cases. That's the entire capacity of the federal criminal court system. Target Corporation alone arrests more than 75,000 people every year. And obviously, so if you take a look at that, not even the federal government could have the capacity to address all of our cases. You have Walmart and all the other retailers, and you can see the scope of this problem. It's not only a federal problem, it's a state problem, and we all need to pitch in. Let me offer one more observation. Why is this problem growing as fast as it is? It's because the persons coming into the stores and stealing the merchandise have a very lucrative place to sell their goods. It's called the Internet. Traditionally stolen goods, if somebody burglarized your home, they would take your 8-track deck or whatever might be stolen from your house, and they might bring it down to a pawn shop, or they might try to sell it to some back alley fence. Traditionally, you could only get about 30 cents on the dollar if you're lucky for that stolen item. But on the Internet, people can sell these items and get twice that, at least. This profit, this enormous profit and access to this large worldwide market is making the return such that we're seeing the growth in theft. So what the bill written by Representative Simon and others does is it gives us some tools to fight this problem, and especially the amendment that's offered by Representative Simon makes it criminal to facilitate the sale of stolen property. So these fences who are helping sell the stolen property are now going to come within the scope of the law. And it's by choking that market for stolen goods that we can begin to put a dampening on this, and without trying to incarcerate the 75,000 people who are coming into the stores. Instead, we can target the state's investment and resources in this into a very small number of prosecutions, and hopefully that'll be balanced by the $40 million or so that's lost to the state in sales revenues. So, again, thank the committee for its time, and encourage you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Representative Simon, I'm looking at cell 5. Is that a tracking of the mental health bill last year to committees, or what?
No. Chairman, I believe that's the House PFL committee.
Oh. I can look the test cards, okay. Especially the one on the end I'd like to hear from. But I have some comments and questions when everyone's done.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might just hand it over to the next test card. Introduce himself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Mr.
Representative Simon. Once again, I'm David Brown. I'm speaking here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and we have not had a great deal of time to look at the details of this bill, and particularly the amended version, but I wanted to let the committee know that the County Attorneys Association is very supportive of the concept and what it is trying to accomplish. And we've talked with Representative Simon, with Mr. Ward, about our desire to work with them to tighten up some of the language and make sure that we can work together to pass this bill that will allow us to aggressively investigate and prosecute these crimes.
You have one more quick question, Representative Simon.
Chair, and I'll have him introduce himself.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Beatles Musnick. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Newport. I've experienced 33 years of law enforcement. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, as well as the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I believe the impact of this bill will have relatively minor impact on the finances or resources of the state of Minnesota.
I also believe that with the passage of this bill, the message to those that have a propensity toward criminal behavior will simply be enhanced. I also believe that certain behaviors, illegal behaviors that are directed toward Minnesotans, those hardworking citizens as well as businesses, will show that the passage of this bill will show that their illegal activity is simply not going to be tolerated in the state of Minnesota. And so there are a lot of law enforcement people in this fair state that support the basic tenets of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, is there any, just a second, is there any opposition to this bill? Could you really wrap it up?
I misspoke when I said those were the last folks. Two people want to chime in here very briefly. Thank you.
Very briefly.
Mr. Chair, my name is Buzz Anderson, President of the Retailers, and I want to thank you for your indulgence as well. This is a very unique crime. It's a growing crime. It has this bill has the strong support of the entire membership of the Minnesota Retailers Association. It's the kind of bill that is devastating not only to our customers but to the safety and security of our employees. It is the type of crime that that seriously affects the bottom line not only of our businesses but of the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I think Representative Simon's bill goes a long way to helping put a dent and curtail this type of crime. I would strongly urge your support.
Can you give very short testimony? Very short.
Very short. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association. We, too, are in full support of this bill. There are two quick points that I do feel are important to make. Some of the items that are frequently targeted are expensive household items, such as over-the-counter drugs, baby formula, razors, and batteries. All of these are sold in your community grocery stores. With these items then being resold through internet, fencing operations, and flea markets, there's a tremendous hazard to consumers. We know these products are tampered. We know that they do alter expiration dates, therefore putting dangerous and compromised products on the market to consumers. We think that this legislation puts appropriate penalties on the severe natures of this crime, and I thank you very much for your time.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, I have just one quick question before then I have to tell two stories because this is what I do when we're not up here, but not as an attorney, of course. In the section regarding the possession, and now you're going to add or use of shoplifting gear, what you're explaining are the little ink pads or the little electronic things that are attached to clothes. Is that correct? Okay, I'm an author on the bill, but what I wanted to point out is that that's very helpful for retailers, very helpful for county attorneys and other prosecutors to handle that, because there is a little bit of vagueness in the shoplifting gear statute, and where the bag that you've all seen is the typical way of doing it. I just want to tell two stories about how this works. One time, groups of people come in, and they have the lined bags with the foil. They come in, they put jeans in there, they come in there, they put household products in there, then they go and they sell them on different, the internet, or they go to pawn shops. And the other one is where people will come in wearing girdles underneath their clothes, and they'll go in and have one group come in and grab a stack of jeans, bring it to the changing room, and somebody goes in and then puts all the jeans and the girdles, and then they walk out. These are very orchestrated, and then they sell them. These are very orchestrated crime teams, and this is a great bill. And I commend Representative Simon for bringing this forward, and for all the stakeholders who are here to testify in favor of this bill. This will help. This is good policy. And thanks, Chief Music, for coming in and testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know what you're trying to accomplish, and I support you. I'm just looking at the list of, where we have stealing a car. I'm looking on page 6, line 6.23. And then I see added on the language that you're trying to do. And my concern is dumb kids that, what I'm looking at here is is a dumb kid that takes a plastic disc or whatever off a piece of clothing and shoplifts. I mean, I'm not justifying that, but is that going to be the same level of crime as stealing a car?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, no, my understanding is the way it was structured, that's a different section of the bill. So I don't believe
that. Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, if you look at page 6, I'm assuming that all of these infractions are treated the same way for penalties, given they're all lumped together in the statute. And so if you look at number 19 on 6.28, to obtain retail property, to cause the cash register and other recording device to reflect less than the actual sale price of the retail property, you could have a dumb kid switch out a pair of $80 shoes for $20 shoes, put them in different boxes. That would cause the price of the product to be rung at up as other than the value, and I don't want to see... I mean, I want to get the bad actors, but there are really dumb kids, and I think almost every kid acts dumb at one point or another. And when I see these kinds of things listed in the same list with stealing a car, it makes me nervous.
Mr. Chair, I misspoke earlier. Yes, it's a different section of the bill. What I really should have said, this would make those activities theft, but there would be no aggravating factor. It wouldn't be ORC, organized retail crime. This would be theft. That would mean that would be a theft charge, but it wouldn't have the aggravation factor in it for sentencing purposes that the other stuff does in the other section of the bill.
And so if I might then the ability to make the crime worse goes into this, doing it more than once for the language, I can't find it here, where you get caught doing it two or three times, then you're in big trouble.
Correct.
But on the first offense, as a dumb kid, it would just be... a theft.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, that's correct.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I understand that to your intent, and I agree with it. I'm not sure that's what the bill says, though, and that just gives me a little pause for concern. I'm going to support your bill going on here today. I want to see this happen, but if you look at page 8 of the bill, when we're talking about the penalties, clause 4 says imprisonment of not more than 3 years or payment of a fine of not more than $8,000 or both if any of the following circumstances exist. And then if you go to subdivision B, the conviction is for violation of subdivision 2, clause 19. If you go back, that's the switching of the price tags thing, I think, and I think that's Representative Holbrook's concern. I think we want to be careful about the issue she's raising. Again, I support what you're trying to do here, and I'm going to vote to help you get the bill out, but I think we need to take a close look at that and make sure that's We're not getting the kids that are doing something stupid once.
Representative Emmer.
That was the same thing. I think Representative Coles and Representative Holbrook are correct. I think you might want to take a little closer look at that.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a fair point, and if that's what the text says, that's certainly not the intent. I'm happy after this to make that.
It's also going to cause the price tag on the bill from a fiscal perspective to go way up, of course.
But you see, Mr. Chair and Representative Colts, he will be, can't book the $40 million in
loss. I got an amendment for it.
No, wasn't $40 million just about the price of the victim's compensation?
I think Representative Simon was trying to actually sneak that one out the emergency exit of this committee and organize legislative crime, maybe. But
Representative Simon renews his motion to pass as amended with recommendation House File 3331 to finance with a further recommendation to go to public safety finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
I'll fix it.
The other bill is laid over and we are adjourned.